there's something that we spoke about at the end of the last session that we had, and I wanted to elaborate a little more on it. You know, Maimonides always said that when an important principle of Torah comes your way, you should always expound on it. In his writings, many times he cuts across some important principles, and he stops everything, and he says, this I must expound upon, because this is a basic principle in Torah. And that's something that just happened recently, because I realized it a little later. But David asked me last time, where did Moses... I said the prophets were all wealthy, the Talmud says, and the question that David raised was where did Moses become wealthy from? Now, a lot of Jews became wealthy when they left Egypt, because they were instructed to take the gold and take the money that they deserved after all those years of work, and they took the money. But Moses, as you remember, wasn't able to take the money at that time, because he went to take the bones of Joseph. And therefore, he lost his chance to get any money in the Exodus of Egypt. So the rabbis tell us that the Talmud in the Tractate of Nedarim, that has to do with vows, and the rabbis tell us that Moses became wealthy from the chips of the stones of the Ten Commandments, okay, the tablets. So the rabbis derived from the linguistically from the verse, because it says in Hebrew psal lecha, it says chisel out for yourself, and there's no reason to say for yourself. It just should have said chisel out the tablets, but it says chisel out for yourself. So the rabbis say that the for yourself meant whatever you chisel out, whatever falls out, the chips will be yours. So the Talmud says that Moses became wealthy from those chips. Now there are a couple of interesting things about that. And one thing is that you see from this interpretation that how different Judaism is, how different Torah is from other religions, because what it means is simply that he took those chips, which were made of a sapphire, and he was able to use them for money. Now, one would think that isn't that kind of sacrilege to take an object like that, that came from the very tablets that God engraved the Ten Commandments on? I mean, that's first of all. Secondly, most people, if they had something like that, they'd think it's a holy kind of a thing. I mean, I remember seeing this show about the flood, and I know David told me that it was basically a fraud, but the person there, he claimed he had this piece of wood from the ark, and he was holding on to this thing. He says, this is, good luck for him. And here you have the chips of the stones from which God actually engraved the Ten Commandments in them. So one would think that this is something holy. But here you see where Torah differs completely from any other religions, the man-made religions, and that is that Torah does not believe in relics or in any kind of sanctity attached to a physical object. That even the chips that came off of those from those very tablets, which had the Ten Commandments on them, those chips were actually nothing more than just precious sapphire stones, and Moses was able to use them for in a monetary way, and it was not considered sacrilege. And on the contrary, if anybody would say that that they are holy, that would be idolatry. That would be avodah zarah, to endow some physical object with holiness. The only thing that has holiness, according to Torah, is that which God instructs us to and tells us that it has sanctity, like the temple and the different areas. There are different levels of sanctity in the temple, but that's only because the Torah and the halacha designates it. But there's no such thing as an object that has any kind of holiness, because it's associated with even if it's associated with gods engraving it, it still has no holiness. And if you believe those things are holy, then basically on the course of idolatry. That's the whole thing with the Shroud of Turin, which was a big farce anyways, but the whole idea of the Shroud was that concept of searching for holy articles is an idolatrous concept. And that's why Moses became wealthy from those chips, and the sapphire stones were very valuable, and they were like cash. It was like money. And as a matter of fact, the Talmud says he became very wealthy from them. So apparently it was worth large sums of money, millions and millions of dollars. That's one concept that we see from there. There's another concept, too, to my mind, because the way the rabbis in the Talmud express it, they don't say that Moses became wealthy from the chips. They say he only became wealthy from the chips, which is a strange kind of expression. I mean, they say he became wealthy only from the chips. So what is the only? Why didn't they just say he became wealthy from the chips? Why did it have to be only from the chips? So I believe the answer to that is something which Maimonides states, and it's something which applies to Ben Israel as well as to a Ben Noach, and that is Maimonides states. You know the way the halachic system works. I mean, by now I think you have some insight into the halachic system. There are always two parts to the halachic system. There's the rigid structure, which I've mentioned. I said that it's like the human body has a rigid structure, has bone, but then it also has muscle, which is supple. So there is the rigid structure of the halacha, and then there is sort of the soft part, which is the philosophy and the ideas, which bends according to the situations that a person finds himself in. And the Torah really incorporates both types of systems. And Maimonides, in the conclusion of the laws of Shemitah, that is the laws of the Jubilee and the laws of the seventh year, so he states as follows. He says that the tribe of Levites was separated from the rest of the tribes, and they were designated to serve God in the temple and to teach the teachings of Torah to the rest of the people. He says, and that's why they were separated from the rest of, from the others. They didn't do battle like the rest of the people, and they didn't receive a portion in the land. And he says they didn't really gain anything for themselves through physical toil, but they were God's army, as it says in Deuteronomy that God blesses his army, and that refers to the tribe of Levi. And he says, and God was the one that gave them their sustenance through the fact that they received the tithes, and also the Kohanim received the 24 different gifts that were mandatory upon the Israelites to give them. But that's the rigid structure of the system, okay? But then there's the philosophy behind this, and that's where Maimonides adds a law. And he says, and it's not only the tribe of Levi, he says, alone. That's the rigid halachic structure. But he says the philosophy of this is that every single person, and here he says, from all those who have entered the world, which means whether it's a Jew, whether it's a Ben Noach, makes no difference. Any person that his spirit raises him to the point where he gains understanding and he separates himself, to designates himself to be before God and to serve God and to know God, and he followed in the straight course, the straight path of Torah, just like God intended man to live, and he removed from himself all the various kinds of calculations that the average person has in his life. He's always calculating his car, his house, his this, his that, how much money does he have, and constantly involved in these type of financial calculations, pleasure calculations, those type of things this person removed from himself. He simply doesn't concern himself with that. He says this type of person is like the holy of holies, and he says, and God is his inheritance forever, and God will give this person something in this world which will be sufficient for him to live on, and he won't have any he won't be in a state of need. He'll be totally satisfied, and he could spend his life in the pursuit of Torah and of teaching and of searching for God, gaining knowledge of God, and rising higher and higher in his knowledge of God. So this is what Maimonides says. This is a guarantee that stems from the rigid halachic system. The halachic system is actually emulating this concept, and this concept is true. And any human being who really designates himself totally, which means, as I said before, he's completely removed from desires for pleasure, for position, for gain. I mean, this is not his concern. Okay, of course, within a rational realm, and we'll discuss that later, a person has to satisfy all of his nature. I mean, that doesn't mean asceticism, but it means essentially that he's devoting the higher part of his nature, his essential thrust, his main ambition is to gain knowledge and to learn Torah and to teach Torah. So he says such a person is guaranteed by God to have financial sustenance without really wasting his time engaging in that. And that's what I believe the rabbis meant when they said that Moses only became wealthy from the chips of the tablets. Why? Because what they were saying is that Moses never gained wealth from any type of physical toil. That he spent his entire life in knowledge of God and in keeping God's commandments and in leading the people and in teaching the people and doing things for the people which God instructed him. And that's why the chips of the tablets was the only way that he could actually become wealthy. Because there he was engaging in an activity which was a commandment of God, and the byproduct of that activity was that he became wealthy. But he never engaged in any type of activity per se for the purpose of wealth. That he never did, because he was the greatest of men, the greatest human being, and certainly he fulfilled the requirement that Maimonides mentions, and that is the person who really designates himself totally to serve God. He was the model and the most perfect human being. So that's what I believe. That's why the Talmud says that he only became wealthy through the stones, the sapphire stones that fell from the tablets. Okay, are there any questions? Okay. Yes.
I think not. Wait a minute. Marvin? Okay. All right. No questions.
Okay.
You may continue.
So those were two principles that you derive from that rabbinical statement. And the first one, of course, is extremely important to remember, and that is the concept of nothing being holy because it's associated with any kind of event, even if that event was an event where God himself was involved. I mean, by the way, from a logical standpoint, if that were the case, the earth would be holy too, because the earth was created by God directly. The universe, the whole universe created by God. So if that's the case, you don't need to look for chips of stones to see
Rabbi,
God's handiwork. God's handiwork is all over.
All right, the question.
Yes.
If these stones were sold, are there any tangible remains of those stones available today?
There could be.
Does anyone know the whereabouts?
It is possible that there are tangible those stones are still available. As far as I know, in 3,000 years, sapphire does not disintegrate, so they should be somewhere on this earth. But again, I just want to point out that if people would find those stones, I guarantee you they would get very, very excited. But I want to point out that excitement is really an idolatrous emotion, because there's nothing to get excited about. Those stones are no different than any other stones that God created. They're all the same. But man has that propensity to... That's why, in my opinion, that's why the prophet had determined to put away the tablets. They were hidden. They were hidden at a certain stage in history, and the reason why they were hidden, in my opinion, the reason why we don't have them is because people reached a level where those things could become have an idolatrous connotation. In other words, these are the holy stones. And not holy because God commanded that they should be holy. A Sefer Torah is very holy as well. A Sefer Torah, because the halacha dictates that every Sefer Torah has a sanctity to it and has to be treated in a certain manner. So it's the halachic holiness that we look for, and not the relics, and not the... And once one gets involved with the idea of a relic, then one is really involved in the same idea as we spoke about with Hezekiah, with the snake of the copper snake. I mean, that's the exact same, that's precisely the emotion. That emotion to give a value to something because it was associated with an event, even if God himself was involved in that event, that emotion is an idolatrous emotion. So while the whole world would be very excited if that happened, it shows you that the world basically is not on the proper level, and their emotions are really basically idolatrous. There's no... What is holy is the ideas of the Torah. That is the holiest thing, and it's an intangible. You can't touch it. You can't see it. Your mind can grasp it. That is the holiest thing, the ideas of the Torah. Okay. Are there any other questions?
Actually, there is, but I can't hear the question.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Is there any specific reason why the fragments were sapphires?
I don't know why sapphire was chosen. The rabbis say it was sapphire. They say it was available to Moses. It was close by outside his tent, near his tent.
But, you know, the text called it huge stones.
It just says stone. It doesn't say what it is. I know the Talmud says it was sapphire.
The text says the stones, yeah.
It doesn't say what kind of stone. Sadia Gaon just says precious stones. He doesn't say... obviously, the stones would be... It would be appropriate that they should be precious stones and not just regular stones. But that's a matter of honoring the object. You know, they shouldn't just be... it's a common type of thing, but it doesn't mean that sapphire is any more holy than any other stone. It's just that was chosen at the time. It could be a matter of availability as well. I mean, that's quite possible.
Well, the thing that you'd have to deal with, if it's the fragments of the 10 words,
right,
the 10 sayings, that
right,
the thing would probably have to be several thousand carat stone if it was a sapphire. Because, you know, it's a pretty big piece of rock.
That's correct.
It wasn't just a little bitty thing, so it would have to be, even though you don't want to attach any idolatrous attractions to it, it would have to be a huge sapphire, the largest one that they had on TV just the other day. The largest one known in the world is 14,000 carats. And that wouldn't even be close to carrying enough to put the 10 words on. That's just a commercial. It didn't cost any extra.
Okay. Okay. I couldn't hear that last part too well. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I want to continue, and the Ecclesiastes, what I'd like to do, the last thing I'd like to mention about Ecclesiastes is for most people, Ecclesiastes is a sad book. And even philosophers who have read it, they say, well, this is a nice thing to read before you die, but, you know, during your lifetime... You want to keep away from this, and you want to have some fun. But because Ecclesiastes, as we mentioned, he breaks down all human fantasies and illusions. And according to Ecclesiastes, you can't actually live life, you can't face life and enjoy life unless you can face death as well. He had, his position was you have to have one common, you have to be on one even keel throughout. And there shouldn't be any change. Because a person has to, in order to enjoy life, you have to be in reality. And denial of reality causes conflict, and therefore you can't be happy. So he breaks down all the fantasies and all the illusions. So most people get very sad at reading it. But the truth of the matter is that Ecclesiastes really is a very happy book. Why? For the simple reason that Ecclesiastes gives you the most important thing in life, and that is the formula for human happiness. What could be more important than that? I mean, if you would want anything in life, if you were to ask God for anything, I mean, most people would ask for silly things, you know, things that really aren't that important. But the really valuable thing to ask God for is a formula for happiness. That's what every human being is seeking. The only thing is people make a mistake and they think that it can be found in money or in honor or in romantic love or in other types of pleasures, but that's not really where the happiness could be found. But Ecclesiastes does show you, if you read him carefully between the lines, he shows you there is a formula for happiness that emerges. And that's why I think it's a very happy book, really. And certainly a very important book. But before we take that, let me ask a more basic question. My question is, how do you know that a person is supposed to be happy? In other words, where do we see in the Torah, where do we see in God's Torah, that man was intended to be happy? I could argue, I could say to you, no, that really this existence is a painful existence, and we're not supposed to enjoy this life. And I can even support it with some of the statements of the rabbis. I don't believe that that's the correct interpretation of those statements, but I could adduce evidence from some of the statements that on the surface would sound like that's correct. Of course, the rabbis say there is no reward in this world for good deeds. It's a statement of the rabbis that way. The reward is really in the hereafter, and exists where the soul exists only without the body. So Maimonides mentions that, and you know, most philosophers maintain that the ultimate level of human existence is without his body, just the existence of the soul. So we could argue, we could say that this whole life is nothing more than a test, really, to, I'm putting it in very, very, I might say primitive terms, but I'm just doing it to make it clear. We could say that this life is really here just so that a person should struggle and choose the good. But where do we see that a person should enjoy life? And what if I don't enjoy life? I mean, really, what does King Solomon say in Ecclesiastes? He says, in happiness, what does it do for you? Okay, you're happy 1 minute, and you have a moment of enjoyment, a night, an evening of happiness, and then the next day you get up and that's it. So maybe it's not that important to really enjoy life. Maybe it's okay to walk around morbid and depressed. I mean, as long as you do the right thing, and, you know, on the contrary. As a matter of fact, there's even a verse in Ecclesiastes that says, the heart of the wise are always in the house of mourning. So where do we see in the Torah that a person should be happy to begin with? How do we know that that's a value, that we should strive for that, or that we should look for that, or we should maintain that that's a good? Do we see anywhere in the Torah that it makes such a statement? There is such a statement, yes?
Rabbi.
Yes.
Deuteronomy 33:29 in the text, the English text. I don't have a Tanakh here, a Hebrew.
33:29. Let me see that one. 33. You sure it's 33? Deuteronomy 33:29?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
You
want to read to me?
All right, it says, happy art thou, Israel.
Right.
Who is like unto thee, O people delivered by Hashem?
Okay. This is the problem. The word, the first word that you said, happy, is really not an exact translation. The correct translation for that is fortunate. Fortunate. Mm-hmm. The word is Ashrecha. Ashrecha means fortunate, really.
Yeah. All right, I told you, I didn't have a Tanakh with me, so.
Right, but you're in the right book, I'll tell you that much.
Okay.
You're in the right book.
Okay.
But it's a little bit earlier where it says, it gives, you know where the curses are, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's Deuteronomy 28?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where it tells the evil that will befall the people if they abandon the ways of the Torah and they don't follow God. So the Torah spells out all the horrors and the tragedies mm-hmm. that actually did befall the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says like this. Hold on a second. Because you didn't serve the Lord your God.
That's 47.
That's it. Because you didn't serve the Lord your God with happiness and
gladness
with a
heart.
Contented heart. Is the translation pretty close to that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There you have the word simcha. Now simcha means happiness, joy. So it says over there, it says, because you didn't serve the Lord your God with happiness and with a contented heart, because you had everything. Because God is saying, I gave you everything. So in other words, what God is saying is, I'm giving you everything now, and if you don't serve, and God is saying that if you don't serve Him with happiness, because of that, the next verse, 48, what's going to happen? Then you're going to serve your enemies that God will send upon you in hunger and without any without anything and lacking everything. And then he goes on with the curses, okay? So it's an amazing thing. This is something that Maimonides pointed his finger to. He says, you see from this verse, this verse and the succeeding verses, that the reason for the curses, one of the reasons for the curses is not because you didn't keep the commandments, of course, that's major. But another reason, and also an equally important reason, is because you didn't serve God with happiness. You weren't happy. God is saying, I gave you everything and you weren't happy. So you see, it's a crime, according to the Torah, to be unhappy. That's an amazing thing. That means if God gives a person his blessings, and a person really has nothing to be upset about, nothing to feel bad about, and he walks around morbid and depressed, he's violating a major principle, a major law of the Torah. All right?
Okay. If I ask you this, then if you took this logic, you would have to say that the fulfillment of the mitzvot is to be the source of the joy.
Well...
Because he said, I set before you this day life and death, blessing and cursing, choose life. And then he tells you what to do. And that by keeping the mitzvot should be the source of the joy.
That's correct.
And the gladness of heart.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
But if you take a look at that verse, that what David is saying is 100% correct. That the source of the joy must be from keeping the mitzvot and doing the Torah, which shows you that the objective of the Torah is to make a person happy. But I want you to understand something. You see, this might be misconstrued because it doesn't mean, and you see, that there's a certain kind of religiosity that carries with it a forced happiness. Like people keep telling, well, I'm so happy I'm doing this, you know. That's not what the Torah means. The Torah means that it's a natural thing, that if you follow the ways of the Torah, you're going to be a very happy person, and you should be a happy person, and you'll enjoy everything in life. Because you see, the end of the verse, if you look carefully at the end of the verse, it says, because you didn't serve the Lord your God with happiness and with a contented heart, then it says, the last two words in Hebrew, meirov kol. I don't know how to translate that. But it means from plentifulness of everything. I don't know, what is your translation?
Okay, it says, ours from the abundance of all things.
Okay, that's good. Very good.
Yeah.
That's a better linguistically. From the abundance of all things. Now, the abundance of all things means, besides the commandments themselves, it means the abundance of the physical things. Obviously, that's what the Bible is referring to, because the Torah says before, right before the curses, it tells... Okay. So now the question is, of course, how do we... now that we know that we have to be happy, or we should be happy... So the question is, what is the formula for happiness? It's very easy to say, but there must be a formula in the Torah. Now, the one that spelled it out, it was Ecclesiastes. He really gave us the formula. Now, The way to discover the formula is to take a look at some of the. We're going to take a look at some of the verses over here, okay? Because there are big problems with being happy, and Ecclesiastes points it out like nobody else did. Now, the first thing is, as I mentioned last time, the important thing is to look at Ecclesiastes' contradictions, because the contradictions are the key. And the verse I mentioned at first, which is in 2:2, where he says that happiness does nothing for you, that's the first verse. But now take a look at 2:24, okay? 2:24 in Ecclesiastes says that there is nothing good for a man other than eating and drinking and giving his soul good for all his toils, okay? And then he adds in the end of the verse, he says, this also I have seen is from the hand of God. What that has to do with the first part of the verse at first seems unintelligible. It's two different things. Okay? Now take a look again at three twelve. Okay? 3:12 is... Yep, he says, I know there is no good in them, he says, but only to be happy and to do good in your lifetime. There he says happiness is good, again. Okay, then take a look at 5:17. 5:17. Over there he says, he says that, behold, I have seen that it is good to eat and to drink, and to see good in all your work, that God has given, that all the work that you do under the sun, all the days of his life, all the days of his life, that God has given him because this is his portion. Okay? Again, that last part where God has given him doesn't seem to have anything to do with the first part. Okay? Then take a look at 8:15. Go through a few verses here. 8:15. Okay? 8:15, he says, and I praised happiness. See, before he says happiness does nothing, in 2:2. Now he's saying just the opposite. I praised happiness because there is nothing good for a man under the sun but to eat and to drink and to be happy. That's a strange kind of formula. Eat, drink, and be merry, it sounds like. He says, this will be something that escorts him in his work on the days of his life which God has given him under the sun. Again, he brings in that idea that God has given him, which again, as you always see, it's tied to that for some reason, in some strange way, which doesn't seem at first intelligible. Okay? And then 9:7, all right, where he says, go eat in happiness your bread and drink with a good heart your wine, because God has already accepted your deeds. All right? So the question, of course, is what is the answer to the contradiction? And the answer to the contradiction is really, there's a statement, an interesting statement of the rabbis. The rabbis say that that this world, one scholar told another scholar, he said, this world is just like a wedding. It's like a big banquet, a wedding banquet. He says that it goes very quickly. And he says, you have to grab and eat and grab and drink while you're here. Because after you die, there's no more physical enjoyment. Now that sounds again like a hedonistic philosophy of eat and drink for tomorrow we die, which is mentioned in the prophets. Okay, I believe it's Isaiah mentions it. So, that's an old hedonistic philosophy which is mentioned in the prophets. And the question is, how do the rabbis and how does Ecclesiastes differ from this in all these statements where he tells you just to eat and drink? Okay. All right. Now, I think the key to that lies in another verse. We have to take a look at another verse here, and that is 3:11. Okay. Verse 3:11. If you take a look at it, you'll see it's a strange thing he says here. He says he made everything good in his time, and also the world he put in their heart, which means in their heart, and their hearts means he put the world in the human being's heart. Now, what does it mean, the world in their hearts? Now, the world in their heart means that a person, and we've mentioned this many times, and that's really the main topic of Ecclesiastes, that a person is always looking for something eternal, an eternity. The only mistake that people make is they think that they found the eternity where they didn't really find it. Like they think they found the eternity in being successful, in being a great businessman, in whatever, being a great religious leader. It could be anything. That's where they think they found eternity. But the truth of the matter is that eternity can only be found in two ways, according to Ecclesiastes. A person does need to be tied to the eternal. A person cannot be happy just with physical pleasures. No human being can be happy that way. The idea of a playboy is a total myth, and anyone that studies the lives of these playboys will see right away how unhappy they really are, because it can't satisfy the human nature. So a person must feel they're doing something of importance, of greatness. I spoke to a relative of mine recently who retired in Florida, second year retirement, and he's playing golf, and he's, you know, he has enough money to take care of himself. And I said, well, you must really be happy. I know he didn't like the profession he was in all his life. I said, now you're free, you can enjoy yourself. He said to me, he says, I want you to know something. He says, I have to feel there's something more to my life than golf. Golf cannot be life. And he says, and I'm really very unhappy and frustrated at this point. So man needs something important, okay? Now Ecclesiastes says this type of importance should come in two ways to man. One is in the link with the eternal, and that is the ideas of Torah, because ideas are eternal. So when you study Torah, and you learn Torah, and you argue Torah, and you get excited about Torah, then you are linking up with the eternal. That satisfies that need in man. The study, the knowledge, that's why Torah is knowledge. Torah does not believe, like other religions, that you go into some kind of religious state. That doesn't make you... That's just another emotion being driven in a different direction. But what Torah maintains is the excitement of knowledge and ideas. That's when you're studying Torah, that's when you're linking up with that which is eternal, and you're satisfying that part of your nature that has the need for the eternal. That's the root. That's where man meets God in the world of ideas. So this is Torah's philosophy. That's one proper way to satisfy man's need for the eternal. The second way to satisfy the need for the eternal is the recognition of the fact that the way you're living, according to Torah, God endorses that way of life, and he knows that you're partaking of the truth. So there's your second link to the eternal. And according to Ecclesiastes, those are the only ways that man should satisfy that need for the eternal, not through any other means. Not through thinking of himself as a great scholar, as a great leader, as a great businessman, as whatever kind of image he wants to set for himself. It is total disaster if he's trying to satisfy that need through those images. So the first thing is that the need for eternity must be satisfied only in those two ways. Okay? Now, the second thing that a person must know, and that's a counterpart of this one, and that is that the need for the eternal should never be satisfied. The worst thing would be to satisfy it through the egoistic desires. The ego of man should never be the root for that satisfaction. Okay, that's one element in the formula for happiness. The next element in the formula for happiness, and perhaps I should have said this one first, and that is never to seek any kind of enjoyment, never to try to find your enjoyment in something which is an illusion. And that we've mentioned before, so I'm just mentioning it again. So that's two elements. Now, there's another element. And that element is as follows, a little more difficult. And this is all through Ecclesiastes. All through Ecclesiastes, he shows that no matter what you do, no matter what route you take, there is never any guarantee. It means to say that a person must come to the conclusion that he must be able to accept reality and know that this world is a kind of a situation where you cannot live with the idea that you have anything guaranteed. Nothing is guaranteed from one moment to the next. We do not know what the next moment will bring. And a person must be able to live on the level where he is in reality, and no matter what his dreams and his fantasies are, he must know they are simply fantasy. But in reality, there is never here we come to another area which is extremely difficult for a person to accept, but is really an important principle of Torah. And that is the concept that a person must recognize that he lives within a certain given sphere. Now, let me explain what I mean over here. See, this is an important point. Most people cannot help but compare lives with other human beings. And therefore, what they do is they always think either the other person has more, in a case where they have more, so then they look at the other person and say, why does that person have more? And that's usually what people think they're concerned about, but there's an equal concern that most people aren't fully aware of. But it is just as true. It is just as true. It's a funny thing. This next thing that I'm going to mention is probably responsible for as much and maybe even more unhappiness than the other type of situation, and yet most people do not recognize it. And that is that we always think, well, if we had everything we wanted, you know, then we'd be very happy. Now, many times in life, people don't realize, but when you're in a certain situation, a certain group of emotions are at bay. And then when you move into a new situation, all of a sudden, new emotions start creeping up that you never knew existed before. And you say, hey, what is this? I thought I'd be happy here. But then suddenly something happens, a new thing comes. I say, now I'm unhappy because of this other reason, which I never recognized before. That's why most people can never predict how they're going to feel. They think if they get this and this, they're going to feel good. When they get it, they usually don't, just for a short time, and they can't predict what's going to happen. Now, there's a situation in life where people may be just running around, just going along normally, and then suddenly they're struck with good fortune, okay? Extremely good fortune. Either they come into a lot of money, or something else happens to them that's, you know, very, very good. And they can look around their lives and they can see, wow, I have a great family, you know, and I am successful and financially I'm doing well. Then suddenly, this very success can cause them, they look at it at another person who is very unfortunate, and if they're soft-hearted, they're kind-hearted, they think, why do I deserve this more than this other person? Look at this other person is just as good as I am, and how come I'm so fortunate and they're so unfortunate? Another person may be ill or whatever. There are plenty of tragedies in this world. So the person who is successful is suddenly gripped with an emotion and they feel they just cannot enjoy life. And many times people don't realize this until they reach a certain point where they're successful. As a matter of fact, one psychologist wrote an essay on this, and he called it Those Wrecked by Success. And it's much more common than we think. It's more common than we think because most people just think that if they had success, they'd be very happy. They're convinced about that. But the truth of the matter is that many people who are successful are even more unhappy than they were before they were successful because suddenly they're struck with a feeling. I mean, it's hard to define the feeling. Let me just use the word guilt or whatever it might be that suddenly falls upon them and they can't fight it. They can't do anything about it. Okay, someone told me recently that Mickey Mantle had that his wife said that he had that problem, that he could not handle his success. The success used to bother him. Why am I so fortunate? And that's why he resorted to drinking and, as you know, destroyed his life. But this emotion, as I say, most people don't realize how common it is because most people are always looking for success. So you'll tell them, if you tell somebody, say, look, it might not be good for you to be successful, he'll laugh at you because right now he doesn't have that problem. He doesn't have that emotion. But if he gets into that situation, he can very well have that emotion when he never even knew he had it before. So life is very tricky. On the one hand, if you're on the low level, if a person really has a situation of tragedy, you know, heaven forbid, in such a situation, you know, the person is really unfortunate. Certainly, they're suffering. And even a person who's in the middle, he looks at the person that's ahead of him, and he feels envious, and he doesn't realize, but many of the people on the top look down, and they feel eagerly miserable. That, by the way, is the reason for a lot of philanthropy. You'll notice people, when they're successful, suddenly they start giving away a lot of money. When they get very wealthy and they get or Lolder, because what it starts bothering them, the success starts bothering them, and then suddenly they get filled with a certain sense of guilt, and then they want to do something for humanity. That sort of relieves their guilt. Most philanthropists aren't really true philanthropists. They're just satisfying another emotion, and that's an emotion of guilt, which is disturbing them. So they satisfy that by giving away large sums of money, and it makes them, it gives them also satisfies part of the eternal, the desire for the eternal. They feel they're going to remember, be remembered eternally. And, of course, as I mentioned before, all those lifestyles are really not really happy, because they're at the same time laden with pain, from another part of their personality. Their personality is really at odds. That's not the perfect life. The real joy, as I said before, is the joy of studying Torah. But, getting back to this concept, so the question is, how does a person escape that idea? Okay, how does a person escape this idea? This is a really powerful one. No matter which part of the scale you're on, you're always subject to a problem. So this, I believe, is the answer to what we mentioned before. You see, he says in all those verses that we mentioned, he says, that enjoy yourself, he says, and he says this is the word in Hebrew is chelik, your share, your portion in life. He says this is something which is given to you by God. That was in the verses that I mentioned before. That's 2:24, and I'm not going to go through all of them again, but in all those verses, at the same time that he mentions the enjoyment, he also says that, so he says, for instance, 2:24, it's good to eat and drink. Then he says, this also I saw is from the hands of God. Now, what does he mean by the hands of God? And what does he mean because this is your portion in life? He keeps referring to that again and again. For instance, in 5:17, it's good to eat and drink, he says, and to see good and holy work, because this is his portion. You see, and then he says again, he praises the happiness, and throughout the entire Ecclesiastes, he constantly, when he mentions the happiness, he mentions the idea of the portion. And the reason is as follows. In those verses, he's giving you the formula, really. And the formula is not to use eating and drinking as a source of the satisfaction of the need for the eternal. In other words, that's the philosophy of eat and drink for tomorrow, we're going to die. Really what they're trying to do is say, get your need for eternity right here in eating and drinking. And that, of course, doesn't work, because that's a fantasy. When they say eat and drink for tomorrow, we will die, what they really mean is eat and drink now and forget about tomorrow, so don't think about that, and the eternity is right now, and that night is eternity. That moment of pleasure is hedonistic pleasure is eternity. Now that, of course, is according to Ecclesiastes, that can't be enjoyable because you have to block your mind out. Once you have to block your mind out, you're in conflict. But what he's saying is like this. He's saying it is important to enjoy things in life. It's important to enjoy food. It's important to enjoy drink. By drink, of course, it means wine. These things are important. Provided two things. Provided they are not satisfying your need for the eternal. Because your need for the eternal should be satisfied through Torah and through the knowledge of the fact that God knows that this is the correct life, the way that you're living. So therefore, the eating and the drinking are just like they're temporary things, but you enjoy them for what they are. Okay? Now, the other problem is the question of my position relative to somebody else. There he says, this is something which is given by God, and this is your portion, and this is probably the most difficult thing for a person to do, but that is for a person to realize in his mind that the only reality is his portion in life. Nothing else is reality. Whatever position anybody else has, whether it's above or whether it's below, makes no difference, because the reality that he has is only that portion which God gave him. And that's why he says, a person must look at life in a way that there is no guarantee. The only thing we know is that God gives certain things. We don't understand why, and we could never know why, because he says those are God's calculations. That's why he mentions that God made man straight, but man desired a lot of calculations. What he means by calculations means man wants to know, why does this person have that? Why does that person have this? Why am I fortunate, the other person less fortunate? Why am I less fortunate, the other person more fortunate? All those calculations must be abandoned. A person must come to the conclusion that the only reality is the reality that God gave him in his portion. If he could come to that, if he can come to that conclusion, and that's the only reality, and in that reality, he can use the need for the eternal to be satisfied through knowledge and through the fact that God knows that his life is correct, then he can be, then it is possible for the individual to attain happiness. So again, basically, according to Ecclesiastes, the formula would be as follows. First of all, removal of all kinds of enjoyments that are illusory and that are pure fantasy. And that means to say the barometer for that is, the rabbis give you the barometer. Anything that a person on his deathbed would think is ridiculous is in fact ridiculous. Okay? So I remember a friend of mine visited the very wealthy Lefrak a short time before he died, and at that time he said, extremely wealthy real estater in New York City, and he said, what does the money help me? You see, now why do you say, what does the money help me? The reason is because before he thought money was all powerful. Now he realizes that's not true. So that means that was an illusion. The barometer the rabbis give is anything on your last day on earth that you would, if you want to know what is reality, think of what you would think of in your last day of earth. And the last day on earth, you won't feel bad if you enjoyed food. You won't feel bad if you enjoyed wine. That's part of natural living. And a person should enjoy these things for what they are, but not for something that they are not. Okay? So that is a major element in the formula, and also the fact that the person, again, never, by the way, one of the things that the rabbis point out, that is never to try to channel energy into the source, into the ego area. That always results in pain. The egoistic drive of man is the worst aspect of his nature. And a person should, it is better for a person to channel his energies into enjoyment of the physical things. Food and drink is fine, a person is entitled to that. But ego, the rabbis say, a person should never satisfy. That's why the rabbis used to say a person should always be extremely humble. What does the Bible say about Moses? He was the most humble person. So a person should never channel energy into the area of the ego satisfactions. That is another major element in the formula. And the third element, the last element, which is extremely important, that is the recognition of the fact that there's only one reality for man, and that is the portion that God gave you, your portion. No one else's portion should affect you. Of course, a person who is less fortunate than you, we're obligated to help that person. But if a person is ill, somebody else is very ill, the rest of the world cannot stand still and just be miserable. That wouldn't be correct either. You have to do everything you can to help the individual, but then when it comes to enjoying life, a person can only function within the framework of life that God gave him or her. That is their reality. And if someone is less fortunate, we have to do everything we can to help the individual in every way possible, but you're not permitted to allow that to disrupt your happiness in life. You have to look at the portion that God gave you. And if God gave you a good portion, and you are fortunate, and you don't enjoy it, then you have to answer to God. Then God will say to you, look, I gave you everything. Why didn't you enjoy it? It's as if you're denying the good that God gave you. That is what it says in Deuteronomy, that God says, because you didn't serve the Lord your God with happiness from an abundance of everything, which means that God is saying, I gave you everything, and you didn't respond properly. You should have been overjoyed. You should have served me. You should have enjoyed yourself and be thankful for it. But the prescription of Torah is a difficult one, because a emotionally, people always go in one of the two directions. But to just be able to isolate your life and recognize, I don't know why God did this or that for other people. That's God's business, not mine. This is what he gave me. I have to work with what he gave me. Of course, if a person is unfortunate, then there is then God will not take them to task for being unhappy, because that sometimes a person is in an unfortunate situation and cannot be happy. The Talmud states that Jacob was unhappy for 22 years when his son Joseph was lost, was gone. And that's why he had no prophecy during those years, because the prophecy only falls upon a person when they're in the perfect state, intellectually, psychologically, physically. The person must have well-being. And Jacob was really in a state of mourning for 22 years, and that's why when it says in the Bible, when he saw Joseph, it says, the spirit of Jacob, their father, lived. So Unculus translates, he says that means that he again received the divine inspiration. So divine inspiration only falls upon a person when they're in their perfect state. If a person, but of course Jacob couldn't help himself during those years. He was living it through a tragedy. So then a person, of course, you know, doesn't have responsibility. They should try, of course, to make themselves as happy as possible, but then that's a different story. But if a person has the situation where God gave them the situation that they can be happy and they are unhappy, then it's simply a denial of the good, and it's a distortion of the personality. And so a person has responsibility. If a person lives the correct way according to Torah, then they should be happy. And that is to follow the basic elements of the formula that Ecclesiastes sets forth. Okay, are there any questions?
No, I think that pretty well covered it.
Okay.
And we certainly appreciate the time you gave us this evening. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, next week I think we'll go back to the tractate on Sanhedrin.
Okay, that'll be good.
Okay.
All right, be well.